From Tennessee to New Mexico, Massachusetts to Wyoming, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Karl Marx was a dark individual whose goal to destroy existing institutions through radical revolution is fueling some of the civil unrest in America today. Dr. Paul Kengor from Grove City College is author of the new book, The Devil and Karl Marx. He is here to discuss. A key U.S. senator announces his retirement, and the U.S. Senate race in North Carolina has been roiled by a sexting scandal. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Cato Institute has released its annual report card on the financial performance of the nation's governors. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Cato's Chris Edwards. And the past actions of U.S. Senate Democrats have paved the way for the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains how on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The philosophy and tactics of Karl Marx are behind some of the civil unrest that has taken place in recent months. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College is author of the book, The Devil and Karl Marx. Paul is heard regularly as a commentator on American Radio Journal, but he's here now to talk about his book and the impact Karl Marx is having on our nation today. Paul, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Paul, in your new book, The Devil and Karl Marx, just in the foreword, as the book gets started, the comment is made that conservatives have blabbered themselves hoarse, denouncing the economic effects of socialism. They have ignored the deeper spiritual questions that actually move men's souls. Looking at Karl Marx and Marxism and the impact that it's having in America today, can you expound a bit upon that statement?
Yeah, sure thing, Loman. In fact, that foreword was written by Michael Knowles, and he made the comment that, you know, conservatives like to say things like, well, Marxism fails because it distorts markets, right? And they like to give these sort of tidy economic arguments, which are true, right? It really distorts markets. I mean, it's an absolute, it creates economic basket cases out of countries like Venezuela, where the oil is bubbling up out of the ground. Places like the Ukraine and the Soviet Union, where stuff just grows. Cuba, I mean, you can drop a seed in the soil in Cuba and have a mango tree up in a few months, but you can't even eat it because the state owns it. So, but beyond that, yeah, I mean, it's a spiritual problem. And Ronald Reagan said to the Irish National Parliament in 1984, he said, ultimately, this isn't a battle between rockets and economics. This is a spiritual battle. And Marx understood that. Engels understood it. Lenin understood it. Marx said, communism begins where atheism begins. Lenin said, all worship of a divinity is a necrophilia. There's nothing more abominable than religion. The Soviet Union launched this, not just totalitarian state, but this atheistic state. And frighteningly, kind of shockingly, there are suddenly now a lot of people in America, especially young people, that are praising Marxism by pretty high numbers. I go through the numbers in the book. And beyond that, the socialism, which according to Marx's Leninist theory, is the final transitionary step to communism, you now have a majority of millennials say they prefer socialism over capitalism, and even many people that say they'd happily vote for a socialist for president of the United States. So it's I think we're at a pretty bad point, and that's one of the reasons why I felt this book needed to be published.
In terms of Marxism itself, they would take any type of social unrest, regardless of the reason behind it, and use it to advance their Marxist view of the world. So when we look at Black Lives Matter, and obviously a very real concern that we eradicate racism from our society, is racism really the excuse more than a reason behind a lot of this, especially the extreme unrest?
I talk in the book about the Scottsboro Boys, which was a case in the 1930s where Communist Party USA hijacked what was genuinely a great racial injustice, Loman, where these African-American boys from the South were accused of rape. It wasn't true. And so Communist Party USA hijacked that case, and they used it to try to attract black Americans and really progressives of all stripes. The NAACP in those days was outraged at what CPUSA was doing. So yeah, there are communist groups, organizations that agitate according to race. One of them, probably the most infamous, is called REVCOM, Revolutionary Communist Party USA, which is run by Bob Avakian. And yeah, the founders of BLM, notably Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza, Patrice has said flat out, quote, "We are trained Marxists." Alicia and I, we do have an ideological frame. We are super versed in ideological theories. That's our ideological frame, our ideological framework. And they even, at the What We Believe section of their website, which, as I speak to you, Loman, is being scrubbed right now. It has actually been removed in the last few days. But you know, people like myself have screenshots of it. There was a line there about how we and our fellow comrades, they use the word comrades twice, and our cisgender allies, our heteronormative friends, the wanting to declare war on what is heteronormative, they said, "We seek to disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure," quote unquote. So there's a lot of that kind of language at the website because the founders, two of the three founders, as Patrice said, are trained Marxists. So it might not be a Marxist organization, and people in the street might not be waving the hammer and sickle, and the typical person with a BLM sign in their front yard probably doesn't have a bust of Karl Marx, you know, on the living room table. But the fact that the founders would point to that, and Patrice even says in her memoirs, which I have, she said, "We spent a whole year reading Marx, Lenin, Mao." The fact that she's telling you that is telling you something important. We communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement that goes against the existing social and political order of things. Marx called for the ruthless criticism of everything that exists, quoting Goethe's Faust, the Mephistopheles, the demon devil character. He said, "Everything that exists deserves to perish." So Marx and Marxists have always been about tearing down.
Again, the book is The Devil and Karl Marx. We've been talking with its author, Dr. Paul Kengor from Grove City College. Paul, folks who are interested, where can they go to get a copy of The Devil and Karl Marx?
Just go to Amazon, amazon.com. And if you want to learn a little bit more about me, and in fact, we have some posts on this, including a short little video where I talk about this, go to our website, faithandfreedom.com, for the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College.
Dr. Paul Kengor, author of the book, The Devil and Karl Marx. Paul, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. There's a lot of activity, a lot of major developments this past week. We're going to try to hit on at least three or four of them. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
In Pennsylvania, there was a major political development this past week, Scott. Pat Toomey, who is a U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, formerly was the head of your organization, the Club for Growth. He announced that he was not going to run for re-election to the Senate in 2022 and took everybody by surprise. He said he also wasn't going to run for governor of Pennsylvania, which had been the prevailing wisdom that he might do. Your thoughts on Pat's decision to retire?
Clearly, Senator Toomey has been just a fantastic pro-growth senator, member of the House of Representatives, and also he led the Club for Growth as president prior to becoming a United States Senator. So we've obviously always been really proud of the work that he's been doing. He was a Defender of Economic Freedom Award winner 7 times over his time in the United States Senate, and he had a lifetime average of 93% on the Club for Growth Foundation annual scorecard. A lot of listeners know that check out our scorecard. It's a pretty demanding list of votes that are the revealing votes of every Congress, and they're the hardest votes to take usually. And Pat Toomey was siding on behalf of economic freedom and liberty and the issues the club advocates on a very, very solid percentage of 93 lifetime rating. So we're really pleased with how good of a senator we thought he was. And now he's got 2 more years. He's got a chance to be the chairman of a major committee if Republicans maintain the majority. And we're going to be working closely with Senator Toomey over the next couple of years to help him advocate for these ideas of limited government, free enterprise, free trade, and looking at the federal budget, too. He's a solid fiscal conservative, and we're excited about the work ahead in the next 2 years.
We would also like to note, Scott, that from the standpoint of this radio program, American Radio Journal, when we founded and started this program, 12 years ago now, Senator Toomey, who, as you mentioned, was then president of the Club for Growth, was one of the founders of American Radio Journal and helped us get up and started. So we have very much appreciated his service in the United States Senate and look forward to whatever it is he chooses to do when he returns to the private sector. Back to Senate races that are occurring in 2020, however, as we've talked about on this program in recent weeks, control of the United States Senate very much up in the air. One of the states, Scott, that you mentioned could potentially go Democrat, or at least was highly competitive, is North Carolina. Really a major development in that race over the past week. Can you give us a bit about the, well, somewhat sordid details?
The bottom line is that the candidate, Cal Cunningham, running against Tom Tillis in the North Carolina Senate race. He's been up for a while in this race. He's been a very top-tier candidate that the left has recruited for the position, and he was really one of the highest recruits that the DSCC thought about for the cycle. Nonetheless, he got into a texting scandal. He apparently was texting another woman while he's married, and there's a lot more that everybody that's interested can research on Google, but the bottom line is it has tightened that race, and I'd say it's clearly a toss-up now when the Democrat had been kind of leading the way.
And this past week, we had the one and only vice presidential debate between Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris. Aside from the fly that landed on the vice president's head during the debate, what did you see as standout moments of this debate, and how do you think it turned out, especially for the Trump-Pence team?
I think that both candidates kept it mostly respectful. Mike Pence has always been a very solid conservative, and he has been a champion as vice president to President Trump in helping the conservative organizations and conservative members of Congress advance conservative ideas. He's clearly well-read on all the issues that they were talking about. And Mike Pence is ultimately very, very key person to the administration when it comes to its constitutional responsibility. And that's why I think a lot of people tuned into that vice presidential debate. Kamala Harris obviously is representing a Biden agenda that has largely been written by folks like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And it's difficult for Kamala, who wants to be portrayed as a middle-of-the-ground moderate Democrat, to really be defending these far-left ideas that the Democrat Party is now completely embracing. Those are ideas about completely repealing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, those big Trump tax cuts. And they want to increase taxes on a lot of middle-class Americans as well. So they've got a lot to kind of think about and talk about on the left, really, if the media is willing to ask those tough questions.
As we look forward now to the coming week, Scott, queued up are the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who has been nominated to a vacant seat on the Supreme Court of the United States by President Trump. I want to give our listeners an overview of what we can expect this week, and when might we expect a final confirmation vote?
Things are on track right now, according to most of the senators that have been publicly talking about this, and I think that's been substantiated with conversations folks are having privately. It seems like the committee is getting the work done that the members want to see completed prior to the committee hearing starting on Monday. And so when that hearing starts, that'll probably be 3 full days of hearings. And so I think a lot of senators look at Amy Coney Barrett as a qualified nominee, and we're going to be moving forward to a confirmation vote the following week, which will set it up before the election. And that's important because it completes another one of the promises that the Senate Republicans and President Trump made to the voters in 2016 and 2018. And that was that they would confirm conservative constitutionalists to to the Supreme Court. And President Trump is largely doing that. So we're really excited about that. And obviously, what Judge Barrett, when she becomes Justice Barrett, represents on the court is, I think, a fair, originalist mind that will not legislate from the bench, but instead will interpret the law to the best of her ability according to the Constitution.
And we will next week talk a little bit more about that after those hearings are underway. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit more about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. And we have over 300,000 members. You can actually join for free if you check us out on our website, clubforgrowth.org. And you can also follow along on Twitter at Club for Growth, with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Each year, the Cato Institute issues a report card on how well the nation's governors have performed in keeping taxes and spending in check. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details on this year's report from Chris Edwards of Cato. Eric?
There are, of course, 50 governors in America, but only 4 of them get A grades in a new report card. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Chris Edwards. He is the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. And every year, they hand out a gubernatorial report card ranking all the governors from A through F. And the 2020 edition has just been released. So he joins us now to talk about that. Thanks for taking some time with us today, Chris.
Hey, thanks a lot, Eric. It's great to be here.
This annual report card, something that Cato has been doing for years. Some states, of course, are now in, let's say, interesting budget territory here due to the pandemic at the moment. Before we get into that, though, Chris, let's cover the basics here. There are 4 governors in this report who get A grades, but there are 7 of them that get failing grades. So what does it take to come out on top, and what does it take to get you put all the way at the back of the class?
I just look at taxes and spending. It's an utterly nonpartisan report. It's not sort of judgment. It's really a data-driven report. If you've hiked taxes and spending a lot, you get a low grade. If you've restrained spending and taxes a lot, you get a high grade. So the top grade this year went to Chris Sununu, governor of New Hampshire. He's done a fantastic job. He's kept spending basically flat. He's vetoed a new paid leave wage tax that passed by his legislature. He's vetoed other tax hikes. He's been fantastic. So he's defended taxpayers, kept spending down. At the other end, we have Governor Jay Inslee, the worst scoring governor on the report from Washington State. He's been in office for 7 years. He's increased spending at an average annual pace of 6.9%. And if you think about 6.9% annually compounding over 7 years, you can see that spending has really soared in Washington State. And he's not happy with just the regular revenues flowing in from a growing economy. He's pushed for expanding just about every tax they have in Washington State. He wants to impose a capital gains tax. He's tried to expand gross receipts taxes and gas taxes and you name it. So there is this dramatic difference in taxing and spending between the best and worst governors.
Of course, you mentioned Chris Sununu of New Hampshire. The other A grades, we just want to give credit where it's due. The other A's went to Kim Reynolds of Iowa, Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, and Mark Gordon of Wyoming. And then there are those 7 governors who got F grades. That includes, as you mentioned, Chris J. Inslee of Washington. Also, my own governor, Ralph Northam in Virginia, Andrew Cuomo in New York, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, Phil Murphy in New Jersey, J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, and Kate Brown out in Oregon. So look, obviously taxpayers in those 7 states are spending more on government. And yes, that I guess includes me too as a resident of Virginia. But is there any indication, Chris, that maybe people are getting more in return in those places from their governments, from their governors?
What's really dramatic and fascinating is that, so New Hampshire, we interviewed the governor the other day, which is available on Cato, and I was just fascinated by that. New Hampshire has very low overall state and local taxes. In fact, if you look at as a percent of income, New Hampshire taxes, all state and local governments, are 40% lower than New York. And so you might think, oh, well, maybe services aren't as good in New Hampshire. But actually, New Hampshire K-12 schools are the third best in the nation. And as Governor Sununu argues, they're just more efficient, and they're just much more frugal with their spending. So it's really remarkable that some states like New York, government is just this very expensive beast. But then in other states like New Hampshire and Florida, they're able to provide much better services at lower costs. And, you know, there really needs to be more focus on those sort of dramatic differences.
We are talking with Chris Edwards. He's the director of tax policy at the Cato Institute, talking about Cato's new annual governor report card, which covers tax and spending policies in the 50 states. You can check out that report at cato.org. Find your governor on there in case it's one of the ones that we haven't mentioned here today. Chris, before I let you go, I want to ask about the COVID pandemic. Obviously, it's affecting states and state budgets. There's been a lot of talk in D.C. recently about a possible bailout for some states or maybe all states. And understandably, state tax revenues have taken a big hit this year because states are really dependent, largely a lot of states at least, are dependent on sales taxes. Are there any conclusions that we can draw about how states and their governors have been prepared for an emergency like this?
So the way states handle recessions is they're supposed to build up rainy day funds or reserve funds during the good times. And most states, to their credit, have actually done a good job over the last decade building up their rainy day fund. So, for example, California has built up a large rainy day fund, and that puts them in a better position now to weather this crisis. But on the other hand, Illinois has actually saved absolutely nothing in its rainy day fund after 10 years of economic growth. So that's why it's running to the federal government. It got like $1 billion special loan from the Federal Reserve System. And so it's states like that that were really fiscally irresponsible, didn't put money aside and save. They're the ones now that are pressing Congress more for more bailouts. I really fear that bailouts are going to create this, you know, really bad incentive going forward, that it'll encourage states to be more irresponsible, such as Illinois. A last point I would put on this is that there's a big difference between cities and state governments. Local governments mainly rely on property taxes for revenues. Property tax revenues are not falling. In fact, property tax revenues are rising, and that's 3/4 of city and county revenues in this country. So all these news stories that are like sob stories about how city budgets are being crushed, outside of a few cities like New York, it really isn't true. State governments have had a modest revenue dip, but they can handle it themselves. They really can without all these bailouts from Washington.
I think that's a great point. Obviously, states and cities are in very different circumstances. They have budgets that are wildly different and different forms of tax revenue, and we really shouldn't just lump them all together. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Eric.
And again, that is Chris Edwards. He is the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. You can check out their new gubernatorial report card, the 2020 edition, at cato.org. You can check out our coverage of state policy and the possibility of a bailout of states and everything else going on in D.C. at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Judge Amy Coney Barrett will be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, and Senate Democrats have only themselves to blame. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Mitch McConnell is right. Amy Coney Barrett should be confirmed as a United States Supreme Court justice, and the confirmation should take place before Election Day 2020. The argument for doing so is plain. It is constitutional. The argument for opposing a pre-election confirmation is equally plain. Her opponents are increasingly confident that they could do better later, either after the election if a new Democrat wins the special Senate seat in Arizona, or after a new Senate is sworn in next year, if Democrats win back the Senate majority. Which of those arguments occupies the higher ground? The constitutional argument in favor of a pre-election confirmation, obviously. The counterargument is no principled argument at all. It's purely political. Many in the media and in the Democrat Party have seized on what they call the hypocrisy of the Republican argument for confirming Barrett before the 2020 election, because they hold that it is the opposite of the argument Mitch McConnell concocted not to confirm or even grant hearings to President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland shortly before the 2016 elections. Frankly, the argument for confirming Barrett now is actually stronger than the argument he used against confirming Garland in 2016. McConnell won the day with his comparatively weaker argument then. He will win the day easily this time with his strong, simple constitutional argument. There is an opening on the court. The president has the power to nominate a prospective justice. He has done so. The Senate can hold hearings and a confirmation vote within the time between now and the election, which is well within recent Senate timeframe norms for Supreme Court nominees. Not only is the Democrat argument against a timely confirmation of Barrett grounded entirely in politics and the lust for power rather than in principle, it is also delightfully ironic that the fix they find themselves in is essentially of their own making. It's all related to the applicability of the Senate's arcane filibuster that requires 60 votes rather than a mere majority for confirmation. Washington Post columnist Mark Thiessen made the point succinctly in a recent column when he said, "They were for the filibuster under Bush, against it under Obama, and for it again under Trump, and now they want to eliminate it." Their first blunder came in 2003 and 4 when they broke precedent by blocking 10 of President George W. Bush's judicial nominees for federal circuit courts. As Thiessen put it, the Senate Democrats' actions were so brazen that in 2005, Republicans briefly considered eliminating the judicial filibuster, but in the end they backed down, recognizing that, as then-Senator Joe Biden warned, "You may own the field right now, but you won't own it forever." But when Democrats won the Senate majority back a short time later, Senate Majority Harry Reid did exactly what Democrats had warned Republicans not to do, eliminate the filibuster for lifetime appointments to the federal bench for all but Supreme Court nominees. This was then their second catastrophic mistake, writes Thiessen, and it came back to haunt them when the Senate flipped back to GOP control. Had it not been for the two breaches of precedent by Democrats, Senate Majority Mitch McConnell would never have had enough support to block a vote on Merrick Garland. Even then, however, Senate Democrats under Harry Reid bragged in October of 2016 that when Hillary Clinton won the presidency and Democrats regained control of the Senate, they would eliminate the filibuster for the Supreme Court. Instead, Donald Trump won, and the Senate majority was in Republican hands. They could mount no coherent argument against McConnell's move to do exactly what Harry Reid had boasted he would do. That set the stage for Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh's confirmations, and now the Democrats are out of weapons to stop the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. If this were the game of bridge rather than the game of politics, such a move might be called an auto finesse. They paved the way for her confirmation. Mitch McConnell is right, as I said at the outset, and Senate Democrats have made him so. Amy Coney Barrett should be confirmed prior to November 3rd, Election Day 2020. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCBC-AM in Manteca, California, WRQV-FM in Ridgeway, Pennsylvania, along with FortWorthBeachRadio.com in Fort Worth, Florida. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.